High School, would they stand, please? Thank you. You may be seated. And Wapaka High School. I guess Lancaster's there. Wapaka's here. Would you stand, please? Stand tall. Good. You may be seated. The students are here with us on the Court with Class program, a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. The students from all around the state are invited to join us for an oral argument. They have been given materials on the case we are about to hear, and some of the classes invite lawyers in to discuss the case with them. And as part of the program, there's a noon presentation with a justice dealing with the process that the court uses in handling cases. And you are all invited, both students and non, to join at noon. And the justice today will be Justice Sykes, who sits at the far left of the bench. And I'll now introduce the other justices, too. Seated next to Justice Sykes is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice William Babbage, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With those introductions made, I'll call the second case today, 01-0507CR, State v. Jennings. Arguing on behalf of the state is Assistant Attorney General James M. Freiman. Mr. Freiman, you have, as you know, 25 minutes and 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the state as petitioner in this criminal appeal. On a plea of no contest, defendant Kevin Jennings stands convicted of one count of third-degree sexual assault. In a published opinion, the Court of Appeals has reversed and ordered the case dismissed on the ground that the trial court lacked personal jurisdiction over Mr. Jennings due to a statute of limitations violation. The Court of Appeals concluded that although the filing of the criminal complaint and the issuance of an order to produce Mr. Jennings from prison for initial appearance were timely, they cannot substitute for either issuance of a warrant or issuance of a summons to commence prosecution under the statute of limitations. Before running through a brief outline of the facts, I'd just like to state the state's position. For either of two alternative reasons or rationales, the state asks this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and reinstate Mr. Jennings' conviction. The first rationale would be a broad rule, broader than just this case. That is that in the case of a warrantless arrestee in custody, like Mr. Jennings, the filing of the complaint should be deemed sufficient to satisfy the issuance of warrant option for timely commencing the prosecution. The second alternative argument in the alternative is more case specific. That is, the filing of the complaint coupled with the contemporaneous issuance of an order to produce the warrantless arrestee, Mr. Jennings, for initial appearance, should be deemed sufficient to satisfy the issuance of summons option for timely commencing a prosecution. In conjunction with this second rationale, this case-specific rationale, if you will, even if the combination of the complaint plus the order to produce does not fully comply with the technical form and contents requirements of a summons that are set forth in 968.04 sub 3, any such error should be seen as just that, a technical defect that does not defeat personal jurisdiction. In particular, failing to attach a copy of the complaint to the order to produce should fall into this category, since notice of the precise charge cannot be the goal of either the issuance of warrant or issuance of summons option of the limitation statute, because issuance occurs before service or execution of the warrant or summons. Also, a judicial finding of probable cause cannot be the goal of the issuance of summons option of the limitation statute, because a district attorney, without judicial intervention, is free to issue a summons based on a complaint that has been filed. Turning then briefly to a recitation of the facts in this case. On December 5th, 1992, a woman in Milwaukee was accosted on the street near her home and sexually assaulted. The assailant's DNA was obtained from a vaginal swab and preserved. Mr. Jennings' DNA was entered into the State Crime Lab DNA Data Bank on July 28, 1997, after he was imprisoned on another matter. On December 1, 1998, just shy of 6 years after the sexual assault, the crime lab made a cold, what they call a cold hit, determining that Mr. Jennings' DNA matched the crime scene assailant's DNA. 2 days later, December 3rd, 1998, two Milwaukee police officers went to the prison and interviewed Mr. Jennings about the DNA match and the sexual assault charge. The next day, the prosecutor, December 4th, 1998, the prosecutor filed a complaint charging Jennings with the sexual assault. That same day, a court commissioner issued to the prison an order to produce Mr. Jennings for initial appearance on the assault charge. He was brought to Milwaukee County on December 5th, 1998, but was too late for a court appearance that day, so the initial appearance took place the following day.
Okay, so on December 5th, you had the offense committed.
I was going to ask you a question.
I was not. That's okay.
No, we don't. I wanted just to ask the, on your historical perspective, we're looking at the statute 93974, and that requires, as your opponent indicates, a two-step process. Why, and I think in the appellate decision, they said, well, that has been the process used by the state when you interpret statute of limitations. In other words, 6 years. And I understand your argument, and that's why you went through the facts as far as what happened when, starting with December 3rd. If we were to accept your proposition, wouldn't we be changing that in the sense that the statute is very clear that prosecution has commenced when a warrant or summons is issued? Now, that didn't happen here. And is there a difference in the legislative history between what you're talking about, understanding a complaint for personal jurisdiction, and here we're talking about the specific statute, and that's the argument, specificity over general.
There's two that it goes back to the two alternative arguments. The first is that because a warrant, there's a 968.041A says that in the case of a warrantless arrestee in custody, a warrant shall not be issued. The state's first argument is that when you read that in conjunction with the limitation statute, that should mean that the complaint itself should satisfy that option since the warrant isn't available. I recognize that there is another statute, the statute on the filing of the complaint, 968.02 sub 2, that says either a warrant or summons shall be filed after the complaint. And that's where the state's second argument comes into play. If the court disagrees that the first argument is a statutory ambiguity premise. In other words, when you read 93974, that language, commencing prosecution by issuance of a warrant or summons, with 968.04 sub 1A that says a warrant shall not be issued in the case of a warrantless person in custody, that reading those together, and then when you read some of the case law that talks about personal jurisdiction is obtained with the filing of the complaint, which is the whole purpose of the statute of limitations, that's where that first argument comes from. The second one is following the statute along the 968.02 sub 2 route, and that is, well, Does that mean if you can't file an arrest warrant because the person's in custody, do you have to file a summons? And the state's answer to that is, perhaps, but in this case, the order to produce effectively accomplished what the summons would have accomplished in hailing Mr. Jennings into court. Now, it wasn't technically compliant with all the requirements of a summons, but for practical purposes, it accomplished the same thing. And it also makes sense in that both a warrant and a summons, generally speaking, are directed to somebody who's not already in custody. It doesn't make a lot of sense to require even a summons when the person is in prison, because you still are going to need an order to produce him to get the custody changed from the prison to the local officials.
Except here, just not except, but here where there was an interview by two detectives,
correct,
which occurred on the 3rd of December, just so you're saying that that in itself, that gave notice to the person, and a reasonable person in Mr. Jennings' position would have understood that he is being charged with this crime.
Right. The predicate for the warrantless arrest that he's in custody, which would be the first argument, the one that the filing of the complaint should be enough. Mr. Jennings qualifies as a warrantless arrestee in custody based on that interview, and clearly anybody would understand at that point. And if there was any doubt when the order to produce was issued to the prison the following day, telling him he's going to be brought to Milwaukee County for charging, that there'd be no question that under the objective test, if you will, for arrest in the Fourth Amendment sense, he would have understood that.
You done?
Yes, folks.
Okay. When did the statute of limitations expire on this crime? If the offense was committed December 5, 1992.
That's a good question. I was trying to determine whether December 4th or December 5th should be the date. And to be honest, I didn't come up with a definitive answer, although the state's position here is that December 4th, if that is the date, that was met in this case.
Okay, so it was either one. That's my first question. What statute governs how you calculate the time limitations? 939.74, right?
That's the limitation.
Prosecution for a felony must be commenced within 6 years.
Correct.
Right? That's how you get from December 5 to either December 4 or 5, 1998 in this case, right? And then the statute tells you, within the meaning of this section, a prosecution has commenced when a warrant or summons is issued. Neither was issued here.
Except that we're saying that...
I know, but
okay.
It wasn't. The exact plain language was not complied with.
Correct.
An indictment was not found.
Correct.
And you couldn't have an information filed, or no information was filed.
Eventually, there would be, but
not on December 4 or 5.
Correct.
So under the exact plain language of 939.74, the state loses. Just on the exact language.
Except that...
Except. The answer is yes, except.
Except that we say that, are arguing that the order to produce in this case, coupled with the complaint filing, satisfied the summons.
You said the filing of the complaint equals the issue of the warrant.
That's the first.
That's under 939.74.
Right. Red? Go ahead.
Then, if I understand your argument, you say the filing of the complaint and the order to produce equal the issuance of the summons, that's under 939.74-2 also? Both your arguments are under 939.74.
Right. It's interpreting that language, right, and applying it.
Right. And that's the statute we're dealing with here.
Correct.
Okay. Do we have case law that would indicate that even if a person is in custody and under arrest, and here he was more than under arrest, he was institutionalized. Do you have case law that would indicate if you're questioning him for another crime, got to give him another Miranda because he's in custody? Or I'll put it differently. The fact that somebody has given a Miranda warning, does that mean that he's under arrest or in custody?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
Right.
Okay. So you can't rely on Miranda saying he's under arrest.
Not per se, as a rule, as I understand it, right?
All right. So now why is a filing of a complaint the same as the issue of a warrant?
Well, I read this from the statutory melding, if you will, of this 968.04 sub 1A.
Which doesn't have anything to do with statute of limitations.
Well, not in a direct sense, because it isn't. Obviously, it's under the charging or commencement of proceedings.
Right. But, and this statute could have said that when you commence the action, that's when the statute of limitations is satisfied. But it doesn't say that, does it?
No, it doesn't.
It has a special section, a special sentence that gives you when you commence the statute of limitations. And that's not the same as commencing an action. Strange, but that's what happened, right?
I'm not sure I follow exactly, but what I'm suggesting is when you read that plain the language of 939.
What is that?
I'm going to say plain. Well, it is plain in the sense that it says warrant or summons.
Right.
But I'm suggesting that that isn't the total end of the question for a warrantless person in custody, because you look at 968.04, which also addresses that situation, and that says specifically that you're not supposed to issue a warrant. The first argument that I'm advancing is that I read those two statutes together to suggest that the filing of the complaint should be enough in that situation because it makes no sense. In fact, you're not supposed to issue a warrant. Now, I can see where...
Does that mean when he's arrested for the particular charge that the complaint is based on?
To qualify as a warrantless arrestee, there has to be some point of arrest, I presume. And our argument is that that point of arrest occurred at the point that he was interviewed in prison on December 3rd. Well, it occurred at the latest December 4th, which when he'd been interviewed in prison, told about the DNA match, given Miranda warnings, told that the case isn't going to be dropped for lateness, and the following day, there's an order to produce to the prison, and he's going to be hailed into court for charging. At that point, on December 4th, he is under arrest and is a warrantless arrestee for the purposes of 968.041A. Now, granted, there is this language in 968.022 that would suggest, perhaps, that if you cannot issue a warrant and are not supposed to under this statute for somebody in custody because it really doesn't make sense to do it, a summons could be the requirement then for a prosecutor to have to do that. That's 968.02 sub 2 is what I'm referring to. And that's where our second argument comes in, and that is that in this case, what was accomplished by issuing the order to produce on top of the complaint satisfied that requirement, short of meeting all the technical form requirements of the summons statute.
Well, does your argument then rely on saying that when he's in prison and they question him about another charge, that is a warrantless arrest?
The case that I cite for that is actually a Washington case. There's no case law that I found in Wisconsin specifically for that proposition. You'd have to, if you looked at arrest in the objective Fourth Amendment sense, you would look at, would a reasonable person believe he's under arrest or not free to leave on that charge? It becomes difficult when somebody's already in prison, in custody. And the Washington case that I cited, albeit a speedy trial situation, not a statute of limitations case, suggests that the point of arrest in that situation on a new charge for somebody already in prison should be when the complaint is filed in that new case. In effect, when formal charges, I think, is the language they use in that case.
Why do you suppose the legislature failed to insert the language involving a complaint? In other words, it says right now a prosecution is commenced when a warrant or summons is issued and the indictment is filed. Why didn't they put in there a complaint is filed?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think it causes some confusion, and I believe it has caused confusion in Milwaukee County, at least in this circumstance. There was a predecessor statute, not to the limitation statute, but to 96804. That was it's cited in the brief at page 11, I believe, in my brief in chief. It was a 954 statute, I believe. And at that point, it said neither a warrant nor a summons is required in that situation. Now, granted, when they revised in 67, I believe it was, and they have this statute that now says for a warrantless arrestee, a warrant shall not be issued. I suppose if you read that in conjunction with 968.022, the answer is, well, then you need a summons. But the state's position on this, I don't mean to commingle the two arguments too much here, but in a common sense way, neither a warrant nor a summons is a real practical vehicle when somebody's already in prison, because both are directed to people who are not already in custody.
It's easy to do, isn't it?
Well, it makes sense. It accomplishes, I think.
You get a warrant.
Excuse me?
How do you get a warrant?
How do you get a warrant?
The DA does what?
I believe that the complaint is filed with the judge, and then the judge examines the complaint and issues the warrant, is my understanding.
The warrant okay without the complaint?
I don't think so, but I'm not sure.
And how do you issue a summons in a criminal case?
There's two possibilities. The judge could do it, or the district attorney could do it. If the judge does it, the statute, the requirements of sub 3 of 96804 requires the judge to make a probable cause finding on it. For the district attorney's issuance, not necessary, just an issuance of a summons to appear.
It's quite easy to do.
Arguably. Although, like I say,
the warrant and the getting a summons through the judge is a probable cause, and there's protection in the defendant of just not filing willy-nilly.
True.
But the second part way of doing a summons, it is easy. And
true.
And the DAs can do that, and that protects the statute of limitations, right?
It would be simpler if it had followed all the technical requirements of a summons. Of course, it did not, and we're faced with that situation and how to answer it. And our position is that it accomplished what a summons would have accomplished.
Well, what about, I preface this question with what's going on in my mind right now, which is whether or not the ways that they list in this section are all-inclusive or just for example.
Right.
Because the thought comes to my mind, what happens in the case of a warrantless arrest for a felony? Usually there's a warrantless arrest. There's no warrant then issued after that.
Correct.
The complaint is filed. There's an initial appearance, scheduling for a preliminary exam, and then an information is filed. It seems to me under that theory, if you are wrong, the commencement of this action hasn't occurred until the information has been filed.
That's right. That's part of the problem, I think, with this, is that I can't say that I know the practice in every county, even Milwaukee County. I was trying to find out precisely what they do, whether they issue a summons or not in those situations. But if they don't, it seems sort of peculiar to have all this process having been accomplished already, and to say that the prosecution hasn't commenced, where you've had, you know, the initial appearance, the complaint is being shown to him, the right to counsel is being informed. Go ahead.
Well, let me try to develop your argument a little bit more.
Sure.
For my purposes. What is the purpose of the statute of limitations?
The purpose of the statute of limitations is to prevent stale charges from being brought and to encourage law enforcement to investigate promptly on a matter that has some age to it.
What's the purpose of the statute of limitations met by the filing of a complaint in this case, or in any case?
I think so. I mean, that's our first argument, that it is a formal document. Certain procedures automatically follow from that filing. And in terms of the probable cause, for example, you have the 48-hour rule, and you have prompt appearance, initial appearance rule, the right to counsel. In fact, one of the anomalies here, if you don't look at it that way, is that in a speedy trial analysis, where the Sixth Amendment right to counsel attaches. The case law suggests that it attaches with either the filing of the complaint or the issuance of an arrest warrant. So you have case law there that says you've got this right to counsel even though there's no prosecution that has yet commenced. I would submit, I guess, that the legislature, it's not clear, at least with respect to the situation of a warrantless arrestee, as to what should happen because you can, when you can't issue or should not issue an arrest warrant, do you have to do the summons process?
Well, and to follow up on Justice Vandlich's hypothetical, if I may, the Court of Appeals opinion as it currently stands with the proposition that a defendant in that situation who is arrested without a warrant, who is sitting in the county jail, is brought to court on initial appearance, served with a copy of the complaint, the complaint is filed, but the statute of limitations runs before the preliminary hearing is held and the information is filed, has a statute of limitations argument in the case dismissed.
Right. And that's a problematic interpretation of the statute to require a warrant or a summons in that situation. I think as a practical matter, it doesn't become a problem in felonies because an information gets filed. And usually the procedure is reasonably soon after the crime so that you don't bump up against the statute of limitations. But in a misdemeanor...
But the preliminary hearing?
I'm sorry?
Information is filed before?
No.
So that could take several weeks.
Correct.
Or months.
Correct. Well, and even worse, in the misdemeanor situation where there is no preliminary hearing, there is no indictment, there is no information. Somebody's convicted, you go through the process, and if a summons was an issue to that warrantless arrestee,
he's convicted, but
no personal jurisdiction, at least in terms of the statute of limitations.
But don't you, in terms of the statute of limitations, I guess, rings in my mind, because you have 939.74, which says, within the meaning of this section, a prosecution has been commenced.
Correct.
I mean, what we're talking about earlier is when a prosecution is commenced, and boy, you've got other sections that deal with that, whether it's whether they've been arrested with or without a warrant and are in custody, and look at 968.04 and the mandatory language and stuff. But for purposes of computation, it seems to me that computation of the time limitations, there is a different definition. Am I wrong?
I think the first argument that the state is making is harder, perhaps, to justify in some logical way. I mean, I don't mean to undercut it, but it doesn't really address the warrantless arrestee situation. But I'm suggesting that when you read that with the 968.14 that says don't issue a warrant, that the complaint should satisfy. But alternatively, even if you read this as a strict construction reading of 939.74, it says either issuance of a warrant or issuance of a summons. The second argument then is that the order to produce here, coupled with the complaint and all the process that happened before that, or the events that happened before that, satisfy the summons.
Is 939.74 ambiguous?
It is when you read it together, I believe, with 968.04 sub 1A.
If it's deemed ambiguous, does that help you or hurt you?
Well, I think it helps in the sense that it allows the court to look beyond the plain meaning of issuing what that means, issuing a warrant or issuing a summons. It gets you to the legislative history, which I would say cuts probably both ways, because there was at least a short period of time where the statute said that neither a warrant or a summons was required. But I think that when you read this together and when you apply it in a common sense fashion, whether you conclude that the complaint is enough in this situation, or whether you conclude, at least for this case, whether you conclude that a summons is required, either is met. I see my time is up, but I will, unless the court has further questions.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal, Mr. Freiman. Mr. Compton, representing Kevin D. Jennings.
Good morning, Justices. Again, my name is Steve Compton, and I am here today on behalf of the defendant, Kevin Jennings, specifically in regard to his efforts to have this court uphold the Court of Appeals decision in this case. If I might, I'd like to begin, as Mr. Frymuth did, with a summarization of my argument. And I believe that it's quite simple. And that is that the criminal action brought against Mr. Jennings in this case was not timely commenced pursuant to Section 93974(1). And therefore, pursuant to this court's ruling in Paulhammer, personal jurisdiction did not attach at the time that this action was commenced. Now, if I understand correctly, the state's argument has been put into two separate arguments, and I'm not quite sure that I understand it completely, but my understanding from the briefs was that the state's first argument was that 93974 essentially did not control in this case, and we should therefore look to the provisions under 968.02 and 04.
Mr. Can I ask you a question just relating to the last set of questions to your opposing counsel on 93974 being ambiguous? Now, the Court of Appeals seem to think it was ambiguous, therefore the ambiguity would go to your client. Now, the opposing counsel seemed to think, no, that is not the case. I just want to ask, do you think that the statute is ambiguous?
Justice, I think when you look at the other statutes, 96705, 96802, and 96804, one does reach the conclusion that we have some ambiguity between the interplay of those statutes vis-a-vis 93974. However, the harmonization of those statutes, I think, was probably resolved by the Court of Appeals. And I think it's helpful to look specifically at Section 93974. Again, first, Chapter 939 is the first chapter that relates to the criminal code. It's the preeminent chapter in the criminal code. Second, 93974 falls under a heading called Rights of the Accused. Obviously, that's a very important consideration for us. Third, Section 93974 is titled Time Limitations on Prosecutions. And I think Justice Bradley was pointing that up earlier with her questioning. And in that regard, I look to that as a very specific title. And the court is well aware of two considerations in that regard. And the first is that statutes of limitations are broadly construed in favor of repose on behalf of the defendant. And then secondly, the principle that penal statutes are strictly construed in favor of the accused. So I think those are important considerations as we're looking at 93974.
Counsel, can I pull through the question? Are you finished answering Justice Wilcox?
93974, as I read it, sets out four means by which criminal prosecution can be commenced. The warrant, issuance of warrant, issuance of summons, indictment, or information. Now, in the case of, let's take a misdemeanor, and there's a warrantless arrest. Okay, so there is no warrant, there is no summons, there is no indictment. You know, there's no such thing as an indictment, as I understand it, in a misdemeanor case. And there's not an information. Well, that tells me that either prosecution has never been commenced, even when a misdemeanor is convicted. Misdemeanor is convicted, which of course is absurd. Or there are other means of commencing a prosecution that are not listed in the statute. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would, Justice. I guess the consideration becomes one of what are the district attorneys doing. I know in my county, down in Walworth County, the misdemeanors are typically issued together with a summons. So it doesn't arise. The summons is issued contemporaneously with the misdemeanor complaint.
To someone who's not in custody, prosecutor to someone who is in custody already?
No, that issue, I think, obviously is why we're here. That it presents a novel issue. I'm talking about the more the mundane, kind of the mind-run cases where the folks are not in court. They are hailed into court via a summons on that misdemeanor.
But that raises the suggestion that the terms warrant or summons in the statute presuppose someone who's not already in custody. And therefore, those requirements would only apply to someone who is not already in custody.
Well, I don't think it necessarily does presuppose that. Again, the mandates of 93974 are strict as to the time limitations. And when you look at that language, it is what it is. Now, the Court of Appeals considered that issue by saying, you know what, that process of filing a summons is a simple one. There's no reason why the district attorney should not have done so in this case. There's no reason within the statute that the district attorney could not have done that. So that's how the Court of Appeals addressed the consideration of whether or not a warrant or a summons should be filed to someone who was in custody.
Well, isn't this really tied in with personal jurisdiction? That's A and B. At least when I was prosecuting cases, even in a warrantless arrest, or warrantless case, the misdemeanor. The misdemeanor came before the court and entered a plea of not guilty, or whatever it may be. Hasn't personal jurisdiction attached at the time that the defendant enters a plea?
Well, I'm assuming in your hypothetical that you've brought him into court without the use of summons.
Right. Called him up and said, come on in, you know, there's a domestic abuse complaint filed against you.
Well, quite frankly, that's a good question. And it's a good question, and it's why we're here. And my response, I guess my first response, is to try to avoid the question and say you don't need to get to that consideration of the summons because 939 says what it says and it's been on the books for 60 years. To tackle it on the merits, frankly, there is a question as to whether or not, pursuant to 93974, personal jurisdiction is attached and the time limits for that action commence.
Well, can't you waive the statute of limitations?
Yeah, I believe that you can. I mean, there's...
So if the person comes in and pleads guilty or pleads not guilty or goes through to conviction and hasn't alleged the statute of limitations, isn't it waived?
I think there's a good argument that it is.
So the only time you're going to get to this is if you don't... if you're too close to the line. Now, if there's a warrant, the judge signs the warrant. Right. It's a good warrant, even if it's not executed, right?
That's correct.
So
absolutely.
The DA leaves the judge's office with the warrant here. Never has to execute it because the guy is already in custody. That would have solved this whole problem.
Right.
Do you think the statute should be amended? And I'm going to ask the state that, too.
Well, there's a good question, and I was thinking of the questions as they were coming to my opposing counsel, that we are necessarily going to be treading on the legislature's toes in this regard if we start inserting and adding words and phrases to the specific statutes to make them fit more properly for our concerns. Again, I recognize that there is arguably an ambiguity between the statutes and the interplay, but it does seem to me that 968.02 and 968.04 do imply that a summons should be filed. So I think that does undercut the state's first argument. So the question becomes, should the legislature amend? There's a good argument that they should. The fact that they haven't, I think, points up that this issue simply doesn't arise very often, where you have an individual who is in custody on different charges and then is subject to an additional charge some or almost 6 years later, thus invoking the statute of limitations.
Mr. Compton, the legislature apparently meant it, because when you look at sub 3, 939.74.3, it says, in computing the time limited by this section, the time during which the actor was not publicly a resident, within the state, that totals it, or during which a prosecution against the act of the same act was pending, shall not be included. And then the next sentence says, a prosecution is pending when a warrant, it uses the exact same language, when a warrant or summons has been issued, an indictment has been filed, or an information has been filed. They seem to have meant it.
And that's the third observation that I have. The one, the statute's clear on its face. Two, that it requires a two-step process. And three, that sub three, as you just pointed out, does seem to support the argument that they meant what they meant, which was a summons or a warrant needs to be issued before a timely commencement of an action.
So what's your argument that, although you may be absolutely right on the plain meaning when you read all this, it doesn't make good sense?
Well, again,
maybe it does make good sense, but enough has been pointed out from the bench that raises questions about the good sense.
And it's always problematic when you get into a kind of a common sense argument. And if you recall the trial court, she relied on the common sense. She thought that it was commonsensical to get to the result that she did. And then she used the words functional equivalent of. And I think it's troublesome for a court to enter into that realm. Here, the statute is clear on its face. It has been applied, I think, consistently for 60 years. And this is an issue that simply has not arisen. Obviously, with any great occurrence, I have also checked the case law, and there isn't anything in Wisconsin that's even remotely close to what we have here. So then it becomes a question of, can you harmonize the statutes as they currently stand to uphold the provisions of 93974 sub 1? And I think that you can, again, based on the arguments that you've heard today.
Could you speak to the question of whether Mr. Jennings was under arrest before he appeared before the magistrate?
Justice Prosser, that argument, or rather that fact, seems to be the predicate fact for all of the state's arguments. In other words, that Mr. Jennings was, in fact, a warrantless arrestee in custody at the time of the commencement of the complaint. And again, here, I find that to be troublesome. And if you just look at the facts, we know that the detectives went to visit with Mr. Jennings on December 3rd. And again, they went for the purpose of questioning Mr. Jennings regarding this incident with Mary Kay. There's no record of the discussion. It wasn't taped in any way. There's no signed statement. Apparently there was a statement taken, but it wasn't signed. Mr. Jennings refused to sign it. There was no actual arrest by the detectives. Right, and that's absolutely clear.
Well, let me ask this. The defendant was in Columbia Correctional Institution, which is in Portland, and he was turned over to Sheriff's Department employees, is that right?
Following the order to produce, he was turned over to Milwaukee County Sheriff's, correct?
And was he in their custody?
On December 5th, yes.
Right, and they took him from Portage to Milwaukee.
That's correct.
Now, you quote from Black's Law Dictionary about arrest, and part of that is all that is required for an arrest is some action by an officer indicating his intention to detain or take a person into custody and thereby subject that person to the actual control and will of the officer. Why isn't the trip from Portage to Milwaukee an arrest, according to Black's Law Dictionary?
The reason why is because the sheriff who was executing the order to produce was undertaking a ministerial function. He was simply going to the correctional facility to pick Mr. Jennings up. the order to produce, which is troublesome that it's not in the record, but it's not in the record, and it does indicate that it simply was commanding Mr. Jennings to be produced back to Milwaukee County for him to go back before the Milwaukee County detectives for further proceedings. So I would assert to you that that ministerial function of the sheriff would not comport with any definition of an arrest.
Well, now, Mr. Freimuth suggested in his argument that the indicia for an arrest, you always know when there's an arrest, when someone says, you're under arrest. But, I mean, in those cases where there isn't that kind of labeling on conduct, there are ways to evaluate whether custody amounts to arrest. And he indicates that all the indicia for an arrest arriving out of custody have been met. And which ones haven't been met?
Well, I disagree that there is anything within the facts that would show indicia of an arrest. So that's my premise. There again, there was no detainer placed on Mr. Jennings when he was at the facility following the detective's meeting. There was no hold. There clearly was not an arrest made. There was not any action taken by the detectives to place him into segregation, to book him, to fingerprint him. And I think the district attorney at the trial court level recognized the problem that he had in that regard. And he says on the record, the detectives would say, if you brought him back in here for an evidentiary hearing, that he was under arrest. But the fact is that the facts show no arrest was made.
Why do you need that, though? He's already in custody serving a likely prison term. They've got his fingerprints. He's, you know, why do we need the technicality of another separate, quote-unquote, arrest?
Well, I guess,
what purpose does that serve?
I guess my response first would be, why wouldn't we? Why wouldn't we want to give him those same...
I would like to ask the question positively. What is it in the law, or common sense, or reasonableness, or rationality that says we need to go through this exercise that seems, under the circumstances, to be totally unnecessary?
Well, I guess I would take Mr. Jennings' position and put him on the stand, and I know that I've talked to him. He says he had no clue that he was under arrest. He had no knowledge. He had no notice of these pending charges. He had no reason as to why it is that he was going off to Milwaukee for these further proceedings. And again...
Well, he knew he was in custody, right? Because
correct.
He's in prison.
Correct.
And... the sheriffs who were there to execute the order to produce and get him from prison to Milwaukee were not going to release him, and that he was subject to their control and custody.
Correct. Although different entities. We had the Milwaukee City Police Detectives versus the Milwaukee County Sheriffs on different days.
He knew he wasn't getting out.
Right.
Okay. And he knew he was under investigation for this old rape charge and that his DNA had been matched, right?
Correct.
And he knew he was coming to the Milwaukee County Courthouse to make an initial appearance on that.
No.
That he didn't know.
He did not know.
But he learned that as soon as he arrived.
No.
Because
he only learned that the next day.
Okay, well, he gets there.
What day is that, the 5th?
The 5th he arrives, the 6th. He gets knowledge. The 6th, he actually appears, and that's when he gets a copy of the complaint. That's his first knowledge of the charges.
But the commencement of the action does not depend upon the state of mind of the defendant.
Correct. I'd agree with that.
And we also don't know at this point actually what was said, and I noticed in the state's reply brief on page 7 that they said in light of the prosecutors proffered to supply supporting evidence from the detectives. If there is any doubt about what we're discussing here, it should be resolved by additional fact-finding, which, let's say that right now we're assuming a person that is in, he knew he was in Columbia Correctional Institution, but you're saying he didn't know some of the, quote, specifics that were brought up by Justice Sykes. So the only way we can find that out really is to hear from somebody.
Well, again, that's a predicate fact. I think that you can get beyond that, and I would hope that you would not reverse and remand for further proceedings as to a testamentary hearing, because again, it's only a predicate fact in terms of whether or not he was a warrantless arrestee in custody. It still doesn't overcome the arguments that 93974 is controlling and should be the only thing considered by the court in determining a commencement of an action.
Is it fair to say that the primary purpose of an arrest or an arrest warrant or a summons is to get the defendant to court?
Yes.
Then why is the order to produce, which serves the same function in this context, not the functional equivalent of that?
Well, and again, the biggest problem I have is that we don't have the order to produce. And I should think that that would give all of us pause. And if we're going to make the assumption that an order to produce is the functional equivalent of a summons, it would be nice to see it. But even if it were of the record, I still think that there are some strong considerations that argue against making it the functional equivalent of a summons. And that is, first of all, I mean, you look to the statutes, and the statutes say summons. They don't say functional equivalent of summons.
Who gets the summons?
The individual would get the summons.
And who gets the order to produce?
The individual. Well, no, that's not true.
No.
The superintendent of the correctional facility gets the order to produce.
So it's not the same.
No, it's not the same.
The summons says to the guy, you come in here, right? You've got a problem. You come in here. And the order to produce says to the custodian in Columbia Corrections, you bring them in, right?
Right.
And does the custodian have to show the order to produce to the...
That I don't know. I mean, I can...
You don't know if it was.
Right.
Okay. Seems to me, Mr. Compton, your only argument is on the exact words of 939.74.
Right. That's
your argument. Yeah. They haven't satisfied the statute.
Right.
Whether the statute's good, whether the statute's bad, whether this court agrees with the policy, or the court disagrees with the policy, they haven't satisfied it.
Yes.
You view that as a technical argument?
Well, I believe that it's the right argument. I know that the court is not...
You think following a statute is technical?
I suppose. I mean, it's technical. It's correct. I mean, the legislature has put things in writing, and we look to the books to make sure that we comply with those statements and those mandates. And I think to jump outside of that would be to, you know, get into the area of judicial activism, where we again start talking about whether a summons again can comport with the requirements, or rather an order to produce can comport with the requirements of a summons, and I think that's very troublesome.
What? You done?
Okay.
What, if any, import is our civil law? You know, you guys, you attorneys, are dealing with criminal law, but what, if any, import in this analysis is our civil law, our civil jurisprudence? We've had cases dealing with something that's comparable here. We have in the criminal law mandatory provisions under 968.03 that says you have to have a summons, and it gives the wording of what the summons should be. And how and when it should be served and stuff. And so we've got some mandatory provisions and, indeed, wording right in the statute of what the summons is supposed to say. In our civil law jurisprudence, we have comparable. We have what the summons is supposed to say. And then we take a look and say, well, you know, we're concerned about personal jurisdiction. You have a jurisdiction over the defendant. Have you given the defendant notice? And then we say, is the error technical or is it fundamental? But in our civil jurisprudence, we have, like last year, if I recall, where an attorney who was not licensed to practice law in the state of Wisconsin, but was in Minnesota and was representing someone in Wisconsin, signed the summons that had all the right words, and we said, oop, that's not good enough. We have the American Family case, where the summons had all the right words, and there was argument, and there was a serving of an unauthenticated copy of a summons. It had, the original was authenticated, but the service was an unauthenticated copy, signed copy. Every word, every I was dotted, every T was crossed, but it was just unauthenticated. And we said, oh, no, 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 that's not technical, that's fundamental. I mean, these are very important things when you're dealing with summons, and it has to be really, really small to be something technical, and, you know, unauthenticated copy wasn't small enough. So here, it just strikes me when the statute gives the exact language and says you shall have a summons, and there's not even a summons, that an order to produce isn't in the universe if this were a civil case. Based on our jurisprudence in the civil law, would say, no way there's personal jurisdiction, because our technical violations have been oh so minuscule. Otherwise, we say it's fundamental. How is that jurisprudence instructive, if at all, in the criminal setting?
Can I just say it sounds good to me?
Well, I thought it might, but I want to know, you know, if this were a civil case, unless we really changed our law, there's no way that an order to produce would have the requirements of the summons that are set forth. It's not even a close argument, unless we made a huge leap in our law. So, but if this isn't a civil case, and I'm asking because I don't know the answer, what, and apparently maybe you don't either,
well,
what
well,
the significance of any is that kind of analysis, technical versus fundamental and civil, applicable to personal jurisdiction?
It is not something that I have considered, but again, I think it dovetails well with my argument that an order to produce, of which we can't even look at, does not comport with the requirements of the summons as set forth in 968.04, which again are pretty specific. And
the point is that in the civil statutes, like in the criminal statutes, you have, for purposes of the statute of limitations, a definition of when actions commence. And then in the other part of the civil code, you have other instructions about how you commence an action. In other words, you got two, both in civil law and criminal law, you have two sets of statutes. Statute of limitations, which includes within it how it's commenced for purposes of statute of limitations. And then you have a whole other set of statutes telling you how you serve the summons, when you commence the action, etc. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And so you got 968 here, and you got, and then you've got 939. And in the civil side, you've got 801, etc., and then you got 893. You got two sets in both places. And what the state wants to do is combine them. And the legislature did not combine them. It's the seems to me that's one of your biggest arguments.
Right.
You accept that, huh?
I do accept that.
Okay, thank you.
Again, sounds good to me.
Could I follow up on the question that Justice Bablish asked? And that is, how do you commence a prosecution and toll the statute of limitations in a misdemeanor?
And again, my understanding is that typically what is done is that a summons is issued.
I mean, if there isn't a summons and there isn't a warrant, how do you commence the prosecution?
Well, again, if you bring the action and the action is started for all practical purposes, and there is no assertion of the statute of limitations, there is an argument that you have waived it. At what point in time that occurs, I can't exactly say, but I shouldn't say necessarily typically with the summons and the misdemeanor. It seems to me that, it has, at least been my practice, that
would
they're
that
always
be,
filed.
Would that be ineffective assistance of counsel to fail to make that argument?
That I don't know, Justice. I and looking back and thinking of the Polehammer case, and Attorney Shallow there raised it at a point in time after the conviction, and that certainly was a good consideration, and he did not raise ineffective assistance of counsel, as I recall. So I guess I would defer in that regard.
Well, following up on those questions, in Milwaukee County there are an awful lot of misdemeanor defendants who are arrested without warrants. A complaint is filed out of the charging conference, and the guy gets brought into court on the initial appearance. There's no warrant issued. There's no summons issued. There's not going to be an information or an indictment under those circumstances. The defense attorney at every court appearance says, "Your Honor, preserving all jurisdictional objections, so-and-so appearing for the defendant," and they continue to do that all the way through sentencing after the guy's been tried and convicted and then sentenced. And so the jurisdictional objections, quote-unquote, have been preserved all the way along. They haven't been waived.
That's
are point. All those people, have they all got statute of limitations arguments?
I don't know. I mean, there certainly is not an easy answer. If there were, we certainly wouldn't be here. But
well, are you assuming that a statute of limitations is a jurisdictional issue?
Well, it's a personal jurisdiction issue here under Polehammer.
Only if you assert it. I mean, if you appear personally, you have you have waived your personal jurisdiction issues.
Well, that's a good question, and I think Justice Sykes points out that the criminal defense attorneys tend to parrot off language which arguably might protect their jurisdictional issues.
Generally, objections have to be specific, counsel.
Right. Just in sum, I would ask that you uphold the Court of Appeals decision and affirm that Mr. Jennings' prosecution was not timely commenced pursuant to Section 93974. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Frymer.
Counsel, could you help me with that? As I understood your argument, you at the very beginning you set forth the two main arguments and then you indicated that the second argument is the stronger of the two. And I understand the second argument, my notes are, filing of complaint and order to produce is sufficient. That was my shorthand of your second argument. Does that capture it?
That's correct.
Okay. I have real problems, as you probably could see, and I would like you to take a crack at it, that second argument seems to require us to say that in order to produce is sufficiently equal to a summons, that it's okay. And it's my belief under our civil jurisprudence that addressing the same issues about commencement of action and what's sufficient to commence an action for statute of limitation purposes, maybe. There's no way that we would allow an order to produce to be the same as a summons unless we substantially change the law. What implication, if any, does that civil jurisprudence discussing technical versus fundamental, and this would be a fundamental defect on personal jurisdiction, what import, if any, does that civil jurisprudence have to these issues of technical versus fundamental and personal jurisdiction that arise in the criminal context?
Let me just preface first by saying that I think, with respect to the state's two arguments, the second argument is easier to see in terms of statutory construction argument, but that we part of our problem is that we think the legislature didn't quite perceive or didn't quite get it right with respect to the warrantless arrestee in custody situation on the first argument. But getting to the heart of your question, the civil application, and I have to admit here that this came up in the moot court that I had in our office, so I can't take credit for knowing this just offhand. I think you start by looking at the purpose of the particular provision that's being required, where the summons is being required. For example, in the civil context, I know that the case law suggests that there's this technical versus fundamental difference, and if I understand it correctly, and I think it's the Gaddis case that talks about problems in form and contents with the summons are typically technical defects. The reason they're technical and not fundamental is because in the civil, it's the service of the proper service of the notice. I'm getting into waters here that I'm not real familiar with, so if I misspeak. That's a difference in the criminal context, I would think, that when you're talking about the statute of limitations, we're not talking about notice of the charge, as I indicated, because it's the issuance of the document, of the warrant, of the summons, that starts, that meets the deadline for the statute of limitations. So I think if you look at the purposes being served here, and of course I would respectfully disagree with that the order to produce in this case in context was not enough when you consider all the information that was presented to the prisoner.
Let me, if I may, again, I'm wondering the import of the civil. In the Gaddis case, which I have before me, and the Schaefer case, and I don't have the American Family case before me, I just have a synopsis of it. But I know at least in some of those cases, that's the same argument. Look, I mean, what's the purpose? The purpose of the summons was to let them know that the summons was commenced, a lawsuit was commenced. I mean, and that got them nowhere. That the purpose, in the civil cases, the purpose was fulfilled because the statute says these are requirements. Is it technical? Is it fundamental? If it's technical, then you get into the second step. Was it prejudicial? You know. So purpose is not part of the answer with regard to civil, but you're saying it is critical
Right. I think if you look at what was not done here in terms of the summons statute, the complaint wasn't attached to the order to produce, and there was no requirement for a judicial finding of probable cause if a district attorney had issued it. Actually, here it was a court commissioner, so you've kind of got a mix of, it isn't truly a district attorney issuing a summons here, you've got a court commissioner. But I would submit that it's a technical defect in terms of the statute of limitations when you're talking about merely issuing the document, because notice is not what is intended, is not what is intended for compliance with the statute of limitations. If it were, then it would have to be the receipt of those documents by the inmate. That's not the case with the statute of limitations. The statute of limitations is geared to making sure that a formal criminal process has begun. And I see my time is up, but if I just could comment real quickly on the Justice Abraham's suggestion that the legislature needs to act here. And I would suggest that it's probably a good idea, but I also would suggest that the statutory construction argument that the state has offered in the broad picture, that the filing of the complaint is enough in a warrantless arrest situation, can be reached. And this, as I understand it, this court has shared powers in the area of procedure with the legislature. And as an example, a personal example, recently it would be the tolling provision that happened with the prison mailbox rule, something that, wasn't necessarily envisioned by any statutory language by any means, but yet the court found that it was a proper and good policy and a way to import that in. Thank you.
Before you sit down, do you have any idea how many of these cold DNA hit cases where the complaint is filed toward the end of the statute expiration, the statute of limitations expiration, and that they were issued without summons?
Norm Gahn is the person who's the real expert in this area, and I talked to Norm a couple months ago, I guess it probably was, and I think he was on his 13th or 14th. As you probably know, the statute...
Is it a complaint or warrant? Because Gahn files warrants, I believe.
I'm not, and that's, I don't know if it was purely the complaint or a warrant with it, but it certainly was a complaint that was issued based on the DNA profile. And the statute has since been changed, of course, now that provides a one-year window when you've when they've made that hit to bring the prosecution. You have to start investigating before the statute expires, but otherwise you're given a little more time. But there's also a period before that statute where some of these cases were being prosecuted, and I think that issue of whether the sufficiency of the complaint, at least based on purely the DNA profile, no name, and nobody knows who did it until they get a match, whether that's a sufficient charging document, I think, is eventually going to get through the system. So.
Now, when they amended it to do 1 year, did they change the statute to from warrant and summons and indictment and information?
I'd have to look at the language. I'm not sure precisely. I think it's just you have to start investigating it within the statutory period.
That wasn't changed, I don't think. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Frymuth. Thank you, Mr. Compton. That concludes our hearing on 01-1051.